Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Green Room, where we speak to entrepreneurs and thought leaders in fintech across Asia. I'm your host, Amrita Veer. In this episode, I speak with Nariza Shamsul-Baharin, founder and managing director of Madcash, a fintech that drives financial inclusion through Sharia-compliant microfinance and data analytics in Malaysia. Nariza, who goes by Iza, started her career as an engineer, working for companies like Nokia and Motorola in the 1990s and 2000s. Iza founded Madcash in 2020 with a goal to improve financial access for women MSMEs in Malaysia. Madcash, which stands for Multiply, Assist, Donate, Cash, works with women entrepreneurs by providing capital and financial education to grow their microbusinesses. Madcash raised a pre-Series A round of $1 million in 2023, led by impact investors, and is using those funds to build their team, AI toolkit, and expansion into new markets like Tajikistan. You can learn more about them by visiting getmadcash.com. Nariza, welcome to the show. I'm thrilled to have you here today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Wonderful. Iza, I think you've had like a really fascinating journey to fintech. I want to start, you know, with your career. You actually began as an electrical engineer. I think you studied engineering at the University of Michigan in the US and actually started working at Motorola. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you get interested in electrical engineering? What was it like, you know, working at, you know, at Motorola and I think the early days of mobile phones?
Yes. Okay, so when I started, I was applying for a scholarship with the government. So they gave me an option of being a doctor, and I'm like, I don't think this kind of thing is for me. So then the guy who was interviewing, he told me that, well, you can do other things, but I don't think you should do engineering because that's for boys. And like, and at that time, I was at the age where I still like, whatever people tell me I cannot do, that's what I wanted to do. So that's how I became an engineer, just because somebody told me that I couldn't do it. And once I got into engineering, I thought, he was right. This is really boring stuff. You know, I should have done something else. But, you know, regardless, we finished. And I think that one of the key things that you get as an engineer is that you learn how to think in a logical way. So I think that's the key things that helped me along the way, the ability to put things into perspective and then to be able to think logically, not emotionally.
Yeah, as I think that's such an entrepreneur mindset of like, someone tells me I can't do something, so I'm going to do it. And I think, you know, amazing, especially I think when you were at the University of Michigan to study electrical engineering, probably surrounded by a bunch of men, I think.
Yeah, it was really good. That part was really fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then, so Iza, then you said, you know, you went to Motorola, you went to Nokia at a really interesting time in the mobile phone sector. What drew you to that sector? And can you tell us a little bit about your time there? I think you also maybe started, I think you mentioned you started in electrical engineering, but then made the shift over to the business side, right?
Yeah. So when I first started, it was mainly, we got our jobs like half a year before we graduated. You know, because Motorola, in those days, they would come to interview you while you were still in school. So you got your job, then you skated through the last semester, you know, happily. And then when I came to work in Malaysia, I thought I was going to the mobile phone manufacturer. Then I ended up in Motorola that did this semiconductor, which was my worst subject ever in school. So I spent the next 4 years understanding what people were trying to teach me while I was there. So there's nothing like experience and learning how to do it on the job that really helps you understand what you're doing and focus on that. And I was lucky enough that when I was working with Motorola, I got to work in Germany as well, where we saw the production happening from beginning to end. So that was an amazing experience. And I can't speak German that much, but at the end of that stay, I could actually understand what people were saying. Oh, that's through body language or whatever, right? So that kind of stuff. So I think it's, and then we moved to Nokia. So in Nokia, I was also an R&D engineer. And that was when we dabbled into working with mobile apps and things like that.
Got it. Oh, so it was actually a Motorola where you started working in mobile apps, because I think that it looks like it set off some mobile apps for the rest of your career, right? I think after that, you spent time at SeaWorks Mobile and Madcat.
Yeah. So because when that happened, Nokia was a joint venture company because they wanted to do business in Malaysia. So the government requires that you have to invest in a company. So that's what happened. And when Nokia pulled out, because you know the story of Nokia, right? When they pulled out, right. Then they asked us whether we wanted to stay or and run the company or Just shut it down. So we thought, okay, we can do this. We had some money in the bank, we can do it. And then instead of hiring somebody who knows what they're doing, okay, why don't you, Aiza, learn how to do sales? So I spent a year learning how to do sales, and we spent all our money. And then it was like if I did it again, knowing what I know today, I would have hired somebody who knew how to do sales.
Yeah,
But
but
it developed me to who I am. If not for that, I wouldn't be who I am today.
yeah, well, and it's Isa, you've got the clear, like the step-by-step methodical, electrical engineering part of your brain, and I think you've got the sales part of your brain, and both of those are so necessary again to like be an entrepreneur and be successful in this space. So it sounds like it was good training at a minimum.
Yeah, because I think one of my first jobs was with McDonald's, actually. So
Oh, wow.
I love being a cashier. I love touching money. So I thought that was so fun, like to be a cashier, to like transact money. So that really interests me.
Yeah, well, and now that you're in fintech, it seems like you've kind of come full circle in a way. But I want to talk about Madcash, but before we do that, I know you actually spent quite a few years at SeaWorks Mobile and Madcat. Can you tell us about those companies, what they did, and your role? I think there was executive director, managing director for a few companies in Malaysia. Like, how do those roles shape you and your journey, and ultimately into you forming Madcash?
So I think as I've always wanted to own a business, right? So mainly because I can't really find a boss that I wanted to work for, right? So then so having your own business, I thought I could set everything up. And the first one, we just took over that Sapura Nokia company. And when first Nokia left, then Sapura left, and I had to find somebody to take over the shares. So we did a management buyout, but I worked with SeaWorks. So one of the guys, he was a friend. So then what we did was we bought over Sapura share, and it became SeaWorks Mobile. So it's actually the same company. It's just that we changed shareholders. And then it's only then that we started Madcat World, where again it's the same company, but we changed shareholders again. So that's how it happened.
And how, your roles there, you talked a little bit about your roles there and how you joined, but how those really shaped your journey and starting Madcash.
So I think when we just took over the previous company, we did a management buyout. We started with people who are your peers, right? Peers or even your boss when you were there. And then all of a sudden I put money into the company, and now I'm the one in charge. So it takes a while, I think, especially for myself as a woman, it takes a while to assert that role, because I wanted to be everybody to everyone. I wanted to please everyone. I wanted to like make everybody happy with me. So when the tough decisions came, it was so difficult to make them. And I have to like find a way where I assert myself. And then I even had people accusing me of, you're being such a man. I'm like, what do you mean? So if you're too assertive, then even your women friends think that you're a man. So that kind of stuff. So it took a while, and I had an amazing coach who told me things like, you are carrying monkeys on your back. So I'm like, what do you mean? So he's saying that in the search for wanting to be popular and wanting to be loved, you take on everything that nobody wants to do, right? So that's not the way to run a company. That's not the way to grow a company. So it took a few years to learn that. And mainly it was because maybe I wasn't prepared to be a business person. So, everything was on the go.
Yeah, wow. That's an incredible lesson. I think Isa, you're making me think of there's like some Harvard Business Review study on like there's like a likability and competence matrix that women are always like stuck with, because if we're too likable, people think we're less competent. If we're too competent, people think we're not likable. And it sounds like when you were kind of thrown into that leadership position, you really had to manage those different interests. It sounds like you did a really good job. And you
So,
ended
because I
up
think,
being both likable and competent.
I know, because I think after being in an MSC, you see the value of having people around you who are smarter than you, right? If you keep hiring people who do not know what to do and they keep asking you, then what's the point, right? You hire people who are smarter than you, who can help you move the company. And I think that's the key part of growing any business.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So, Isa, then I mean, an incredible career across several different companies, going all the way from electrical engineering to kind of the business sales side and then the management side. And then during the pandemic, I think in 2020 is when you launched Madcash. Tell us a little bit about that. I think the mission is really interesting, and I think perhaps a bit different from what you were doing before at Madcat. But how did you really get into this fintech financial inclusion space?
So Madcat did mainly software development work, right? So when we build something, we pass it to the customer, and we never actually see the people who are using it. So during the pandemic, the projects were still running for MedCat, but I had nothing to do with it because people were not willing to spend more money. So they just wanted to finish the project and all that. So then I was driving people nuts and they told me, why don't you do something? So like, okay. Then because we had this idea for building a fintech for some time. In 2019, we entered this, it's a financial innovation lab conducted by United Nations, UNCDF.
Oh,
And that's
nice.
when we learned about how fintech works around the world. So it was an amazing experience because we met people from Africa, we met people from India. So we looked at how other people did it. And with all the limitations that they had, they were able to build an ecosystem of people using digital money and learning about financial inclusion. And I came in with this concept of, since Malaysians are so generous with their donation, can it go forward? You know, like instead of every day you hear somebody's, oh, I need food, I need this, you know, can I use that funds and make it paid forward? So the idea of giving a 0% loan is so that it will keep on paying forward. When somebody pays, it helps another woman, then it helps another woman. So that's how it started. But then you realize that after like 3 months, we realize that it's not enough to give money, you know, because when you give money, it just goes away. So you need to also look at how to grow a business, how to stabilize it, you know, how to take it to the next level so that if a pandemic happens again, people won't see this issue. Because like it was only during the pandemic that people lost their jobs. And you really see people having nothing on the table because they didn't realize that they live that kind of life because money came in every day. It's only when the government says stop working or you can't have a business open that you see that there's nothing on the table. So that's the key.
Yeah.
Driver,
yeah.
I think.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I'm remembering back to the pandemic, you know, at the beginning, certainly everyone just sort of stopped what they were doing. And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, I was at Grab at the time, my Grab drivers, they didn't have a source of income because nobody was on the road. Nobody was, you know, ordering things. Nobody business kind of came to a standstill, I think, especially in this part of the world. And so you're right. Then you have a cash flow problem. And where does it come from?
And you can't expect the government to like keep giving handouts, right? And it's never going to be enough. So then that's, I guess, the motivation for doing what we do. And I really, because I've done a few ideas. I had a few ideas that I wanted to push forward and see if it can grow into a startup. So this was really, I think, at the right time, right place and right product. Because, you know, I never used to believe it until I saw this happen to myself. I'm like, oh, it's true. You know, because I thought these people were like, you know, what are you talking about? Right product, right time.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense until you like see it. You have like a very visceral example. It's really hard to like understand like the issue. So, I mean, as I have to ask, like, you know, you decided to focus on women entrepreneurs as your customers. Why was that?
Mainly because that's our network. You know, like at that time, I was also president of an NGO, Women Entrepreneur NGO. So I thought it's a way to leverage on things. And you see that people who are really, really needing help with the women. So we still have very little in Malaysia, we still have less access to finance if you're a woman, right? So mainly because you don't own property or somebody's in your husband's name. And then you yourself expected to do so many jobs, right? You're the mother, you're the sister, you're the parent carer, you know, so everything is on you. So therefore, when you ask people for money, they're a bit like, should we give it to you? How old are you? Like, do you have children? You know, so it's quite difficult. And because women in general, they don't build that credit scoring, you know, unless like I started as a professional, therefore I have like my bank accounts, I have my credit cards. So I see that, okay, the first time I bought a car or a house, I'm able to get the credit limit. But if somebody doesn't have all those, they can't. And their only option is to go borrow money from family, which is always dangerous because like if you don't pay back, you can't go back to your family for the annual reunion and stuff like that, right? Or you go to Alongs, the loan sharks, you know, which is a safer bet if you're able to pay on time.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. As I wanted to talk about women kind of at the end as we sort of zoomed out, but since we're talking about it now, I think let's just go ahead because I think you said a lot of really important things because yes, I think at first glance, women were your customers, women entrepreneurs were your customers for Madcash because they were in your immediate network. But in reality, you're scratching at something else, which is that like women are completely underserved by the financial system, which is crazy because I mean, I'll just quote a few facts for the audience here. MSMEs, which I believe are your customers, Isa, account for more than like 96% of all enterprises in Asia Pacific. 50 to 60% of those are led by women. And they basically contribute up to 40% of GDP in some Southeast Asian markets. And so that means that like women have an outsized impact on, you know, the macroeconomics. And so when something like COVID happens and there's like a massive shutdown, if women are underserved, as you said, for many of the reasons you articulated, and what did you say? I think there was like, obviously there's like kind of, you know, the lack of digital savviness, there's lack of, you know, digital IDs and property sometimes, lack of bank accounts, lack of, you know, property, all of these things I think that you mentioned are really worth digging into, because that is why women are so underserved by the financial system. And it's why Madcash, what you're doing is so important.
And also you see that women, they take care of so many people. So when you help one woman, you know that you'll be helping everybody else that's under her care, right? So you can see the impact growing bigger and bigger as that goes along.
Yeah. There's like another stat, which I don't have totally written down right now, but it's there's another stat that's like women tend to use their earnings for taking care of their families, taking care of their kids, school fees, putting food on the table, whereas men tend to use money. Some of it is for that, but a lot of it actually goes towards other things, entrepreneurial pursuits, other things, other consumables.
So again, then it becomes a vicious cycle, right? So if you're earning an income, but you don't show it, you don't put it into a bank account, you know, that the banks can see, okay, you are earning a revenue every day, right? But you don't show it, and there's no way for you to prove that. So this is one of the things that we teach, where how do you create that bankability with the bank? You know, like how do you prove to someone that I have revenue coming in? I think that's what Grab was doing, you know, like to show daily income statement and things like that. And that helped eventually Grab drivers to be able to buy a motorcycle or things like that, right? By showing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Having like a new source of data, a new source of information that you can actually use to approve people for loans is super important. I want to get into the Madcash model, but I want to finish out this piece on women, because it's so important what you're saying, Isa. And I think especially for women, right, who are sometimes not as tech savvy, they may not necessarily be on the Grab app. They may not be using some of these digital tools to enable their businesses, and therefore kind of the extra data that produces that allows them to be eligible for a loan, to remove the information asymmetry from a credit provider, doesn't exist. I mean, one of the other things that is important to note about women SMEs is that they do tend to be less digital. They tend to serve more informal economies. And like, I think this is changing a lot with like social commerce, TikTok, Instagram, et cetera. But in general, because women are more informal in the way they operate, some of these digital tools that you're mentioning like may not always be accessible.
Yeah, I think the one thing that the pandemic has really helped push would be taking online payment. You know, all of a sudden you see QR code popping up everywhere, right? And the banks have made it easier for people to sign up to have a QR code so that you can at least show something moving in the digital space. And I would say that I think one of the reasons why it's harder for women to adopt technology is because usually they're on their own. They don't work in a multi-people company, right? They don't employ people. Usually it's them on their own. So because of that, there's not enough time in a day to do everything that needs to be done. And also, I think one of the things that has happened in Malaysia is that if you set up a company, like even an enterprise level, you are no longer eligible for the help that the government is giving. So therefore, women are hesitant to do so because they find that they need that help. But if they register a company, automatically they are removed from that list, right? So then it becomes a deterrent for women to register their business and be seen as contributing to the economy. So these are the things that we've been pushing through like every budget. We push for this. Let's separate the need to give welfare and the wanting to set up a company. You know, so it should not be interrelated because those are two different things. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're so different. Well, and to that point, Isa, you know, obviously Madcash is doing, you're doing your part to solve this problem, but there are many stakeholders in society. Like, you know, there are banks, there are other tech companies, there's the government. What can these other stakeholders be doing to improve access to finance for these underserved women entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so the banks are one of our biggest funders, actually. So what we do for the banks is that they want to work with the group that we are working with, but they find that it's a little bit high risk and there's a lot of management that needs to be done, right? So then they give us their CSR funds. And then from there, we fund these ladies. And then once they have grown up, you know, if they're stable enough. Let's say we're looking at our own data, we think it takes about 2 years for somebody to come in, either they're blacklisted or they have some kind of credit history or something. It takes about 2 years for them to get out, you know, of that. So once they're okay, we pass it back to the bank. Okay, here, you know, they're ready now to bring a bigger business or build something larger.
Yeah, that's amazing. So then you're effectively building the pipeline for the banks in a risk-free way or a lower risk way, and almost like reducing the need for your initial product in the first place. I mean, there's always a need to onboard more women entrepreneurs, but you know, eventually you can kind of graduate them out of your system, which is really
That would be good because I think like when you have a society that's too dependent on handouts, you know, it doesn't help grow the nation either. You know, we have to somehow get that thinking out of the way, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Isaac, we've been dancing around a little bit. I mean, of Mad Cash a little bit. And, you know, we've talked about the customers that you're serving. Dance around the model a little bit, but let's get into it. Like, what is the model and how does it? I think there are a few parts to it. I think there's a microloan part, there's a data analytic part, there's a mentorship part. Tell us about all the pieces of Mad Cash and how they fit together.
So the definitely when we started, it was just the microloan and it's given at 0%. So we're not making any money from the loan itself. And then the question becomes like, what are we, a charity? You know, how do we sustain ourselves? And then when I talked to people and I started looking for other funding, we realized that people are willing to actually provide program fees, right? So then if I take you in, I stay with you for a year, I charge a certain fee, and somebody's willing to pay for that. And somebody else is willing to give that loan amount that we could, you know, keep circling around. And some funders are even willing to do both. So that's how we found the business model. Because I think for anything to work, it has to at least break even, right? If you can't sustain yourselves, then you don't have a business, actually. I mean, it's okay if you just want to be a charity, but it doesn't work if you want it to grow beyond where it is. So as we grew, so now we have the program fee. So the program fee, what we do in that is to actually get people to use, like learn about financials, learn about business. So we have an academy. So it started with the Academy for Women Entrepreneurs, which we did in collaboration with the US Embassy. And now we are building our own academy as well because we needed to go a bit deeper and maybe localize it, you know, so that we can address more ladies. And that's one component. And after that, we found that mentorship is also important in order for a lady to see that you can be somebody. Because you tend to find as well, women feel guilty about having money. You know, somehow like this money shouldn't be mine. I should give it to my husband, my mother, or somebody, you know, or my father, right? So there's that guilt of having money. So when you bring a mentor in, the mentor just shows you that it's okay to have a bit of money and then you can give back. You know, you can give back to the community, you can do more things, but it's just that you are more financially independent and you won't have to depend on someone all the time. So these are the things that they make up the whole thing. And now that we're growing a bit bigger, so we're thinking, can we build a whole ecosystem? Like if you're a farmer, would you like to sell your products to one of the ladies that use your products? Like say you're a cocoa farmer, can we sell your cocoa to the baker, to the chocolate maker, you know, so that we can build an ecosystem of supporting, you know, women, other women.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. And I have to ask, Isa, so the and I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. So you've got donations coming from like independent funders. These independent funders, they will say, okay, am I investing in like a specific woman entrepreneur, or am I investing into like a fund that
No.
then you are then deploying based on the loan
Yes.
applications that you get in?
Yes. So usually what we do when we work with, because we used to take public money, but now we don't because it's quite difficult to manage the AMLA issue and stuff like that. So I don't want to be like having to justify why this money come in. So we work only with corporations at the point in time. So when they give us a specific amount of funds, we ask them, to whom would you like this fund to go to? Like who would you like to work with and all that? So we identify the group of women that they want the funds to go to, and then we run the same program everywhere. It's
Got
just
it.
the selection of the women is dependent on the
Got it. Got
funder, right?
it.
So we found that we tried doing like one off, you know, like okay, social media, you come in, you want to be this, and then so it's a lot harder to manage those compared to if you bring in like 10 people in one community. So
Right.
then you have that support system as well. and it'll be easier to manage, you know, because like you still tend to find a situation where if they don't see your face, they don't pay you. You know, so
Oh,
there's a bit of
interesting.
on ground work. So now I have about 36 people on ground in 12 states to run this. You know,
Yeah.
so yeah.
Well, that was my next question, Isa. So I mean, I've like, seen the Mad Cash website. It seems like you're definitely not giving out just donations. You're not just giving out cash, right? Yes, it's interest free, but there is a whole like loan application process. And so tell us a little bit about like your risk assessment and your collections process, because typically in a microfinance model, I, told you this before we were recording, I started my career in microfinance. You in those like historical models, it's very hands-on, right? You have to a lot of people in the field, you have a lot of like manual operations, a lot of manual documents to go through. But Mad Cash being tech enabled, how are you doing things differently?
So one thing that when I first started also, I'm one of those people like if I don't know how to do something, I look for someone who does. So I was lucky enough to find these two people from India, and they actually one of them had experience running a micro financing in India. So she was telling us, okay, these are the things that you need to look at. These are the questions you need to ask. And then she explained why we asked this question. So we learned from there. So we the whole application process is a bit intensive, like 70 questions, but this is what we need to have in order to decide whether we want to fund you. Because we're not looking for people who want money. We're looking for people who want to grow their business. So that is a challenge by itself. And we can tell that if we select better, there'll be less handholding. So this is where we're working on improving our AI. Like, can we use some kind of, you know, assessment method where we can profile better? And now we have about, you know, enough data, I think, to be able to see that. So I'm just getting my friends who are scientists to come in and, you know, help me look at this data. Yeah.
Amazing.
So we're still like a startup. So wherever we can get, like, can you come and help me? Then we do.
Yeah.
So mentors, and things like
Amazing.
that.
Well, and so I guess as a to your earlier point about, women are underserved financially, a large reason for that is because, they don't have assets, they don't have an ID sometimes, they don't have they may not be digitally savvy. How is Mad Cash addressing those issues?
Okay, so for one thing, when we give, you know, access to finance, we don't really look at whether because all of them come in with some kind of credit history, there's some kind of bad, you know, either they're blacklisted or they're this and that. So as long as you're not declared bankrupt, because I wanted to work with the banker, but I found out that the law says that they are not allowed to receive any funds, you know. So I'm like,
Oh,
okay,
wow.
that's fine. So we'll just work with the blacklisted and those. So that's easier. And the whole goal is you have to pay your debt and you have to get out of that debt. So we're also negotiating like one of the most common debts that people are stuck in is their study loan, right? So they felt that the money come from the government, so therefore there's no need for me to pay because it's government money. Until you try to run a business and you wanted to get a loan, and nobody will give it to you because you have this really bad credit scoring somewhere. So then our goal is to work with the agency and see if we can negotiate a way for them to get out. You know, so these are the things that we look at. So like, if I bring somebody in today, in 2 years' time, will they be investable or bankable? So that's the general theory, and that's where we're going towards. And it's difficult, I think, in terms of asking people for collateral or some kind of property because they won't have it. You know, so we just work within what we can, and we give actually very small loans. You know, not everyone will want our loan.
What are the sizes of the loans? And I guess also an important question is like what kind of default rates do you see?
Yeah, so it was like we give between RM 1000, which is like $200, all the way up to $1000, which is 4K to 5K, right? So during the pandemic, we had like 100% payback. You know, everybody paid back and stuff like that.
Wow,
After the pandemic,
amazing.
we saw more cases, and it's not that they haven't paid back, it's just that they are very late in paying back because we don't behave like a bank, right? So if you say that you had an accident, you need 2 months off, then I'm like, okay, 2 months off, right? And then if you say that this month I don't have enough, I only have like 100 and you're supposed to pay back 200, so I'm like, just pay the 100. You know, so we want to get people into the habit of paying no matter whatever amount you have. So we have a lot of laties. We're still thinking what's a good name to call them. So they're not defaulters, but they're late payers, right? So that's the kind of stuff. So, but unfortunately, like last month, we had one case where somebody has passed away, and another case where another lady was bankrupt. So for those two cases, we are declaring as a write-off.
Yeah, and I guess you have to, which
Yeah.
is, you know, what you have to do in any managed port in any you know, credit portfolio. That's
It's new to me, you know. It's new to me. I was living in this bubble, and I was telling everyone that, oh, women are so such great paymaster and all that. And then like, okay. And that's one of the reasons why we keep our loan size to only 5K, so that we can take them. So now we're allowed now behaving like a real microfinancing. So we have like a recovery process. We can take you to court. That's the last thing that we'll do is take you to a small claims court, you know. So.
Yeah. No, and I think it comes with learning, right? Like you're learning, you're training your risk model, you're training your process, and it's totally normal, I think, as you're growing a credit business. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Isa, one thing I also wanted to ask you about is, well, actually, one thing we should dig in on is the data analytics piece. I think that's another part of the business. You mentioned this around, like, you know, assessing the data better, kind of even talking about AI. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So these are the things that we're still in identifying. So there are things that we do where, okay, so I do the process and all that, which is a little bit more manual. So I selected my group of people that I want to fund. Then I can see that there are some batches that are doing better than others. And then I'm comparing what's the difference between the two and how can we filter better the next time around. And then as I'm looking at all these people that are in our program, I met another data scientist who said to me, why didn't you look at the people we rejected? I'm like, oh, because I rejected like 3,000 people. And then they're like, look at those as well to see what made you reject them, and then if you run, a profile again, would you have selected them instead? So this is highly interesting stuff. I tried to learn it myself. I took a data science like a course online, and they told me there's no programming. The first day is programming, all programming. So it's like so I only finished halfway. Then now I'm like, okay, that's fine. Let's learn from the experience before. Let's find somebody who knows what they're doing to come in and help us look at the data.
Yeah,
So we're
makes
still
sense.
looking. Anyone out there who wants to come in, please reach out.
Yeah, you know, good plug, Isa. Yeah, any listeners out there who want to help Isa on her data analytics, please give us a shout. Isa,
Sorry for that.
no, it's great. It's great. That's what we're here for. Isa, one other piece that I think is really unique is the fact that in Malaysia, there is, I guess, a lot of financing is Sharia compliant. And I believe that all of Madcash's financing is Sharia compliant. Why is this? Why is it important?
Yeah, so I think sometimes people confuse Sharia compliant with being Muslim. So we fund people who are not Muslims. It's just that a Sharia compliant business means, firstly, in Islam itself, if you are giving someone cash, you cannot charge an interest on the cash. But you can do things like I buy an oven for you and I make it into business. So I take a profit on the oven. That's fine. I sell a bike to you and I make a profit. That's fine. It's just that cash alone is not allowed to be something that you take an interest on. So then when we talk about Sharia compliant, it's also the kind of business. So we don't fund people who do gambling businesses. We don't fund vape. We don't fund, so it's just the type of business that you're running. So it has to be something that benefits the community. So that's the loose, the loose definition of Sharia compliant. So it's just that, and we are open to anyone, any religion.
Yeah, absolutely. And Malaysia has a very strong history of Islamic and Sharia compliant financing. I think established in like the 1960s, it was actually a way for Malaysians to pay for Hajj expenses. And I know this because I spent the first time I went to Kuala Lumpur, I spent like 4 hours at the Bank Negara Museum,
Oh
which
my
has
God.
a really, really wonderful history of
Yes.
Sharia financing. My embarrassing fun fact is that when I'm on holiday, I always like going to the central bank museums. And I have to say that the Malaysian Bank Negara Museum is like by far one of my favorite central bank museums.
Seriously, because I go to their cafe a lot, but I've never been to the museum. Okay, I should do that.
Check out the museum. It's very good. It's
Okay.
very good. And it has this whole history of Sharia financing in Malaysia, but as well as like globally. And I think, you know, in Malaysia in particular, like when I was at Grab, we launched Sharia financing, our Sharia compliant loans for our drivers. And it just seems like there's this growing interest in Sharia compliant loans. I mean, just because there's a history of Sharia compliant financing in Malaysia doesn't mean that all financing is Sharia compliant, but it does seem like in recent years that's growing. I think I was just reading a Star article that Sharia financing is now 45% of all financing in Malaysia. Is there, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, Isa? Like why that is? Is there a growing interest?
I guess it's like if you're taking something that you earn a profit on, So the profit is usually bigger than if you do conventional, so that's why
Really?
people are like, yes. So if you look at the amount of, I mean, they call it investment. Yeah. So whatever
Okay.
profit you get from there. Yeah. So it's usually bigger. And then it's also, I think it's the transparency usually in how Summit Finance is being done. I would say that's one of the reasons why people go that way.
Yeah,
Right, so
yeah.
but when I go around the world, people cannot believe that you can run a business at 0%, because the business does not have to be dependent on that. You could build a business around it and leave that financing at 0%. So these are the things that people don't get, because when you work with a group of women, there's many ways that you can tap on that. Once they are bigger, they grow stronger financially, they can look at buying insurance, they can look at buying other products. So there's more ways that you can make money surrounding them.
No, I think you're so right. I think I think a lot of times us in like the lending world, we say, okay, you have to employ this one business model. And that doesn't always have to be true. There are many other ways to have a sustainable business model that can be Sharia compliant. It can be innovative in many other ways. And so I think it's really nice to see innovative models like that gaining traction. But Isaac, back to Madcash, tell us, where is the business today? What's your traction? What's your impact? And also, can you tell us a little bit about your recent fundraise?
So in terms of the funds that we have under management, so these are the funds that we give out. So we started with 3,000 ringgit Malaysia, which is about $700. So now we have 3.2 million, so which translate to 700K, something like that, right? So that's the amount that we have. So these are the money that we use to give out to people, and then at the same time, I also, the revenue comes from running the programs, and the recent. We've had two investment rounds. So the first one was the pre-seed, which happened last year. No, it happened 2022. And then 2023, we raised our pre-A fund. So I'm lucky, I think, to find investors who believe in this. Like, I think one of the first few investor Quest from Singapore, they were specifically okay to invest in impact fund. So usually that's a big thing for VCs to do, because they know that it'll take longer for them to get out, and what's their ROI, so it won't be as exciting as if you put into a P2P or something like that, right? So I would feel that finding the right investors, finding people who believe in what you're doing, is critical to making a business grow.
Yeah,
And
as a company.
there are people out there, so you don't have to settle for someone.
Yeah, I think a lot of aspiring, impact entrepreneurs out there would be happy to hear you say that, because I know that fundraising can be really tough, but it's nice to hear you say that there are impact investors out there that are willing to be patient with their capital and
Yeah,
support
but
business.
you must be making a profit. Usually I hesitate myself to invest in a business if there's no money on the table, right? You have to be able to earn some kind of income. Then only you go out and ask people for funds. If
Well, and
not,
then
you'll die,
otherwise, otherwise it's a donation. And so yeah, it
That's
has
right.
to be able to earn a return. As a last couple questions, I know we're almost at time, but wanted to ask, with this pre-A that you raised last year, I think it was $1 million, how do you hope to use that growth capital?
Okay, so one thing that we have now is that we have people doing their roles. So like it used to be me, myself, and I. So now we have like people, real people who actually look at things. So there's someone who looks at the account, someone who's pushing me, like, where's the money coming in, and all the stuff. And somebody who manages the operations. So it used to be me. So when it was me, I would just do what's needed. Like, oh, we're auditing now. Then I focus on that. So like now it's happening on a. So we have better governance. So we can show like, okay, things are happening. Things are well managed. So I think that's one of the reasons why we raise funds. Another one would be to invest in more AI tool, because we know that we are labor intensive. So we need to reduce that. And we're looking at ways that we can do so. And I think thirdly would be to build a new business model. So like one of the things that we invested in is the academy. So the academy, we created our own content so that we have IP for that. And then, because like end of this month, we are going to Tajikistan. So
Oh,
in
wow.
Tajikistan, yeah, so it was like just happened. So then with Tajikistan, we are able to like now have content that we can give them. We have the platform ready, so that way we can explore other markets. You know, because the goal would be, if I know how women in Malaysia are behaving, if they're micro entrepreneurs, can I see the same thing in Tajikistan? Can I see the same thing in Indonesia? Can I show that, you know? So that would be the bigger play.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's a very, it's great ambition to be able to like take what's working in Malaysia and apply it in other markets where there are women entrepreneurs who face similar issues. As that last question, which is really just, you know, tell me about your vision. What is your vision for women entrepreneurs and Mad Cash, you know, in maybe 5, 10, 15 years? What does that look like? What does success look like for you?
Well, I would like to be a bank, I think, a bank for women, so that if you get rejected by other banks, come to us, you know, so that we can operate as a profit-making entity and do it in a structured manner. So I think one of the ways that we could do that would be if we're able to really then expand our scope, you know. Because I'm also inspired by the ladies in India, how they did it, you know. So they have a women bank there, and I'm like, if they can do it, we can do it too, you know. So I'm greatly inspired. So I think that's
Absolutely.
one of the things that we're looking forward to in the future. And it would be to see women have that choice of being able to earn an income for themselves, right? So that you're not dependent on somebody giving you money who is going to like kill you in the end of the day, right? So we don't go to your loan shops, you know, come to us. So that would be our vision.
Amazing. As a, I love hearing about your vision for the future, and I wish you all the best in achieving that vision. Good luck with everything, and thank you so much for being here today. I've learned so much from your story.
All right, thank you.
Thank
And
you,
thank you so
Aiza.
much.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Green Room with Amrita Veer. Listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe to get the latest updates. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we would really appreciate you leaving us 5 stars, a review, and passing us along to your friends. And if you know anyone who'd be a great guest or have any feedback, reach out to us at greenroomfintech@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Catch you later.